And so happy to have with us this morning in the studio, Mr. Ken Coleman is with us, Vice President of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association. Ken, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good to see you in here. And of course, as we are talking about, mostly commercial fishing, kind of going at things from that angle this morning, we'll be revisiting this topic from some other perspectives throughout the month, of course. But we would love to hear from you. 283-8414 is the number. Feel free to give us a call, 283-8414, if you would like to get in on the conversation as well. And I guess just to sort of start off, Ken, looking back to the 2018 season, we know was sort of yet another season that wasn't terribly friendly for salmon fishermen in Cook Inlet. And maybe we could just sort of start there and get your thoughts on the 2018 season and what you're hoping to see maybe turned around in 2019.
Well, 2018, of course, ended up being a very poor season for commercial fishermen. I'd venture to say throughout Cook Inlet drainage, particularly in the central district where the east side set netters and the drift fleet reside. But there was a middling forecast for 2018. We'd hoped that might have been the low end, and as fishermen are, we're very hopeful that we'll have bountiful catches. And predictions are baselines, and it turned out to actually be less than that. There was a 2.5 million sockeye prediction for the Kenai River. It ended up being some 750,000 less than that. In addition, it was the second latest or the latest run on record, which precluded the set net fleet in particular from having any meaningful harvest in the last part of the season, if any. As a matter of fact, the Kasiloff River was what had a fair prediction, ended up being about 170,000 less than that prediction. So it was really lower than anticipated, and you would see in the catches that they were much lower than his history. And in fact, in the upper beaches, many people only fished 3 days. The run predictions for 2019 are more robust. There's a 6 million prediction sockeye run into the Cook Inlet, of which 3.8 is predicted to go into the Kenai River, and nearly 900,000 into the Kasiloff. The Kasiloff is somewhat less than the historical average of over the last 20 years, and the Kenai River is somewhat above. So we're hoping for the best. There are, of course, extenuating things. There are other species that swim. It's a mixed stock fishery. And, of course, we are concerned, as most fishermen are, with the Chinook biomass and how that affects the sockeye fishermen, which is primarily what we're targeting.
Of course, yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because this whole thing, when we're talking about commercial fishing in Cook Inlet and how that impacts sport fishing and all sorts of other things, the king salmon portion of that discussion is paramount. It's right at the center of everything. It sort of drives the debate, drives a lot of management decisions, and from that aspect, I guess, how would you sort of characterize it? Going back, say, just sort of the last several years, how would you characterize how that king salmon component has played into the overall management, and how has that affected your operations and those of your colleagues on the commercial side?
Well, it greatly affects how we fish. The set net fishery is bifurcated, if you will. There's a couple of different the east side set net fishery, I should say. There's a Blanchard line south, which is a midpoint on Kalifonsky Beach to the southern area of Nanilchik, and then the area above that is the Kenai, East Forelands, and Sal Madoff section, and that goes from the Mid K Beach to Boulder Point out North Kenai. And so the Blanchard line south fishermen start early, fish a lot, and we don't get in the Kenai section where I reside, we don't get to start until the 8th through the 11th, the first regulatory day. So it makes a big difference on how the fishery is prosecuted prior to July 8th and then after July 8th. The low abundance or run timing has a great effect on how much and when we get the fish. We are trying to mitigate our catch of king salmon so that we can obviously have opportunity for sockeyes, but it greatly affects the entire salmon management plan, and particularly for the upper beaches later on in the season. We really rely on our August component, and so we typically get started as normal, and then we get, as the last few years have shown us, we get shut down in the meat of the season, and it greatly affects how we fish and profit.
And the business aspect of this is something I'm really curious about, because, you know, sort of given all of these challenges and when the fish are coming in and when you're allowed to get at them, if you're allowed to get at them, has greatly changed, I would imagine, how small set net operations up and down Cook Inlet has to have changed how they do business and the way they get their product out there. At least on some level, and maybe that's something you could speak to a little bit, is how sort of the marketing of that product has changed and how those businesses are able to adapt a little bit. I know that sometimes there is no adaptation because there's simply no fishing to be done, but given some of those newer constraints that are becoming seemingly more and more normal, unfortunately, how are those business plans kind of changing to get along with it?
Well, many people, and this includes the entire fishery, are self-marketing. They're icing and bleeding fish and selling them to restaurants or flying them out of state in insulated totes packed in ice to larger customers in the breadth of the United States. In fact, the entire Cook Inlet fishery, at least from the east side and a drift fleet, is now fresh fish or fresh frozen fish market that no longer goes to foreign areas. But most people have done that. They've diversified as best they can. Others have increased the size of their footprint by buying up area around them and putting all their chips, if you will, into a bigger pot and say, if I get X amount of days, I want to have as much exposure to the biomass as I can. And so, in effect, trying to make a full season's profit in a few days. And that is one way around the lack of opportunity based on all these interweaving management plans we have.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because that takes so much work then sort of on the back end in terms of how do you add value to that product on the back end, market that product, distribute that product. That's a lot different than just simply offloading it to a processor and sort of cleaning your hands and cleaning the deck and being done with it.
It's work intensive. It's no longer as simple as doing what you suggest. It's a lot more back-breaking labor, in the sense that you've got to handle each fish. You've got to, your product has to be pristine as possible, and so it's changed how we do business. And so you have to, even though you may have increased the size or increased your business or enlarged it, you still have that baseline labor that you have to do. And so it's a trade-off, and it's becoming more difficult to juggle when we have these up and down seasons. It's hard to get crews, it's hard to get experience, and it's putting quite a burden on the commercial fishermen.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of touch on that as well. You know, we hear about commercial fishing sort of broadly and very generally. We hear about the quote unquote graying of the fleet, and how do you characterize the demographics? And is it getting difficult to recruit maybe a younger generation to come in? Are the family businesses staying in the family, that sort of thing?
Well, it is becoming more difficult to get people to become involved. Some of that is the volatility of the runs, the regulatory instability is how we characterize it in the fishing fleets. It seems every 3 years that the fisheries board changes something that disrupts or makes you do business somewhat differently, and so. People hear about that around the state. Those are crew hands that would normally come and think we will have a great season in Cook Inlet, now go, gosh, will they fish at all? And so that sentiment also transcends the family unit. Most of the Cook Inlet fishermen, and I would say on both the drift and the set net side,
sure,
particularly the set net side, are family operations. My kids grew up on the beach with me and was one of the most my wife and I would say was one of the most important parts of their lives and ours. We got to have our family unit all together all summer long. Those kids, if you will, now mine are all grown up, are looking to other areas for their careers because of all the aforementioned regulatory instability, fluctuations in runs, and political pressure on fisheries, particularly in Cook Inlet.
Bringing that sort of angle of it up, you know, that's, we're talking now about sort of the almost like the cultural aspect of what this commercial fishery is, and in those terms, of course, it dates back decades, hundreds of years, or not hundreds of years, but over 100 years easily here in Cook Inlet. How does that cultural aspect play into it? I know you've been very active in the policy debate among how to prosecute these various fisheries for a long, long time. How does that cultural aspect sort of play into that broader discussion of policy and trying to kind of level things out? Because that tends to be the goal, is what you want to do for any business in any market, is level things out and not have so many spikes and dips and valleys and things. How does that cultural part play into the policy discussion?
Well, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's a real balancing act. We're having, as you mentioned, we've been involved in the set net fishing. Well, I have for 47 years, and I'm maybe a newcomer, but some of my neighbors and friends have generations of family involved and are the current generation of four or five preceding them. So it is a cultural as well as an economic issue for us. And it's I don't know how to characterize it perfectly, but we're looking for stability. We would like that there'd be some predictability, as predictable as you can be in a natural resource driven business. But culturally, it's a big part of who we are. We have done this, as many of us, for decades and decades and generations, and it's ingrained in us. It's taught our kids how to be good workers, self-starters, and we would like this culture to go into the future as it has been in the past. As you said, we've been here for about 140 years as part of the cash economy, and it's who we are. It's not just what we do, but it's who we are. We try to project that to our elected representatives and the representatives on the Board of Fishery who adjudicate our regulations. And it's a big part of who we are. We're a uniquely Alaskan fishery, the Eastside Set Net Group is. We're about 86% Alaskans, 80% who live here on the peninsula. So we're really a local group, a local businessmen who have a long history and culture in the local economy.
You know, getting with that, I kind of want to get into maybe some of the policy stuff a little bit, of course, and give out the number. 283-8414 is the number if you would like to get in on the conversation this morning, talking all about commercial fishing in Cook Inlet, the upcoming salmon season, of course, looking a tad bit brighter than the 2018 season. Speaking with Ken Coleman, he's the vice president of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association this morning. Again, 283-8414 is the number. Talking about some of the policy things, what are you seeing? What's sort of on your radar? Before the show, we were talking a lot about your efforts at gear reduction, and that's kind of a term that we hear tossed around a lot when we hear policy discussions regarding fishing and how to conserve a resource and yet provide access to all these various user groups. When we talk about gear reduction, I'll kind of let you maybe define sort of what that is and some things that you've been working on.
Well, the east side of Cook Inlet has a limited area and space. It runs from geographically from the Neilchik to, let's say, Captain Cook Park. That's generally considered the east side fishery. And there's about 440 permits or 440 businessmen there. That's far more than it used to be historically, and that was it occurred because the proliferation occurred for a number of reasons. Spatial areas were filled in, historically high catches in the mid-80s into the late-80s, historical high price, which resulted in an influx of permits from other areas and permits, other areas in Cook Inlet, which gravitated toward the east side. In a more modern era of today, we no longer have enhancement that helps bolster runs. We have a larger sport fishery. We have a larger, we have a very large personal use fishery. The drift fleet takes a 50% or more share, which is historically normal. And we find ourselves, is there enough fish to go around?
Right.
Many of us, not just myself, but many groups or groups of people have been talking about a reduction in size for a number of reasons. Economic viability being the primary driver. Predictability, as I mentioned before, and stability. So the premise is that we would reduce our size by voluntary means for a substantial payout, if you will, using a hind cast of what is a permit generally make and cook in, a set net permit, I should say, over the course of 10 years, and then that would buy not only a permit, but the locations or the lease, either or, that is associated with that, and that area would then close, that area associated with that permit. Now, what that does is allows the fishermen upstream from that, if you will, to have enhanced viability, economic viability, and for many of the beaches, that's something that we strive and have striven over the years to try to get back to be viable as much as the resource will allow us to be.
And permit buybacks have been a very hot topic of late. It looks like we have a caller on the line. See if we can go there now. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
Yeah, good morning. This is Bill Sullivan calling.
Morning,
hey,
Bill.
Good to hear Ken on the air there. It sounds like he's got a couple of seasons, not very many more than I do fishing, and I've probably got a couple of years on him in age. Hey, just so that we understand things, Ken's a set netter. I'm a drifter. And I wouldn't want the impression out there that every time the Board of Fish whacks us with another closure or puts on another restriction or something, that we can just adapt and start selling to fresh markets and all that stuff. For some of us, that's just plain not possible. You know, I fish by myself sometimes. Sometimes I have crew. It's hard to get crew. There's no way that I can market fish by myself. Some people have winter jobs. How are you going to sell your fish in the winter? And to draw a couple analogies that might be reasonably fair, it'd be like taking a auto mechanic and letting him be an auto mechanic until he gets to be 66 like I am, and then tell him in order to continue to be an auto mechanic, he had to own a car dealership. You know, I mean, it's totally unreasonable. Or a real estate agent. Now you got to have a real estate company in order to sell. You can't just go do it with somebody else. So a lot of the restrictions they put on us are, you adjust and you get by, but you don't have the same fishery. And there's, you know, for the drift fishery anymore, and I know it's true for the set net fishery anyway, as well, the profitability in this thing, especially with these runs being done down by management and over escapement, the profitability is just not there. I mean, you do not make money. You might pay your expenses. Anyway, just wanted to throw that in there.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Bill. And maybe that gets to a bit of a question, you know, when it is so difficult, we were talking just before Bill called in, talking about this idea of gear reduction and the interest of sustainability and all these sorts of things, getting some permits out of the water, some nets out of the water. Maybe is it an easier sell for the very reasons that Bill pointed out right there?
Well, I'm not sure I make that correlation. By the way, Bill's absolutely right. The drift fleet has a much harder time doing those kind of value-added things than a set net does.
That is a whole different game, yeah.
It is. It completely is. And I don't want to speak for Bill or any of the folks over on that side of the house. But would you state your question again so I can frame it properly?
Well, given all those challenges that Bill just pointed out, you know, and then taken in conjunction with this idea that we are trying to see if there are ways to get a few nets out of the water and buy back some permits and those sorts of things, do those conditions make it an easier sell for people to kind of get out of the business voluntarily?
Well, I think it does. I think that people who have felt like they've been marginalized over the years by, like Bill talked about, changes in management plans that have put boats in particular places or reduced time on beaches have been economically harmed almost everybody to some degree, and many to the point of bankruptcy. And so, to the extent that they could withdraw from the fishery voluntarily, obviously, with a fair amount of money for having closed down a business in perpetuity, is attractive to them, because, as I mentioned, many of these people are fishermen, and they've been doing it for a long time, and they want to continue to do it. To the extent that they could perhaps go somewhere else, just throughout Bristol Bay, for instance, where set nets and drift fishermen are buying and selling all the time, very robust fishery, and their love of fishing would drive them to do something like that. And so those kinds of people would look at a reduction. Also, and you had mentioned the graying of the fleet, because it's less attractive to get in. The folks that are here are getting older and older, and like me, the gray hair, have no hair.
But that all adds up to just experience.
It does.
That's right. Ken Coleman with us this morning on the Kenai Conversation, talking a lot about commercial fishing, set netting, Eastside set netting, sort of in particular. Of course, over the coming weeks, we're going to be diving into this topic a little bit more with some other guests down the road here on the Kenai Conversation as we look ahead to the 2019 fishing season. Wanted to take a step back a little bit and look at last year. We started off the show talking a bit about what was eventually claimed a disaster in some circles of the fishery last year. Maybe you could break down some of the details. You know, I'm curious about what some of the numbers are when it comes time to make that case of a disaster. What sort of numbers get produced and get thrown into that calculation for consideration?
Well, we primarily use the sockeye numbers for deriving it at a total of how much did the fishermen make. I know the drift fleet did it on their side. I certainly, as part of the KPFA and others, looked into what are the criteria, if you will. The criteria that we used to ask the state for an economic declaration was the NOAA criteria, which is if you have an economic loss of 80% or more based on the previous 10 years average, then it's a presumptive loss. And it doesn't matter why, whether it was a failure of a management technique or a run failure, whatever it might be, a weather failure, for instance. I mean, you could cooking that's so dynamic, the whole run could come through in 2 or 3 days, and you might have the biggest storm of the year, and everything could go literally jump right by and be gone.
Yeah.
So we used that as a baseline, and came up with with numbers. Again, we have a kind of a bit of a mixed fishery with two different components of the management plan. But overall, we are very close to the 80% figure, a little bit above it, north of the Blanchard line, a little bit below, south of the Blanchard line. But we tried to approach this from a holistic view. We're all in this together. We sent the facts and figures to the governor, economic development, and labor and economic development, and they declined they declined a set net request, and I think they declined a drift request as well. The only place in Alaska that was declared a fishery economic disaster was the Chinook fishery last year, which was absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and
non-existent.
One of those years that is just it's bad by any measure, but maybe not quite as bad as it needs to be for some relief. You know, as I've paid attention to this to this fishery and the debates around the fishery, over and over and over again, we hear about the need for more science-based information in our decision making and how these things go down. And I guess I'm curious, you know, from your aspect, what are some of the science issues or some of the science questions that you pay attention to and that you think are important to have some study done in order to, again, the overall goal being, as you've pointed out a few times, stability and some certainty in this fishery? What are some science questions that you kind of pay attention to in hopes that they'll provide some guidance toward that end?
Well, we're very, as commercial fishermen, and based on what we've seen over the last 10 years or so, some people say more, some people say less, but what should what should an escapement number be in the particular river system? The Kosilov has an escapement which routinely gets goes over the top. Some would debate why it does that, and the Kenai, some would do exactly the same. How come we have a 1.5 or $1.6 million or fish escapement when the yield from those the large escapements seems to be going down? So we would like to know, from the commercial fisherman's view, is the science that surrounds, is there science that surrounds those escapement goals? Is it sound? Does it provide for a yield that conforms somewhat with maximum sustained yield or sustained yield? That's a big issue for us. Smolt out studies, knowing what goes out of the river so we can try to get an idea of what might return. Of course, those are all mixed up and mitigated for or less based on ocean conditions and things like that. We need to know that science. For instance, last year we had a poor run, much less than anticipated. There was an absence I don't know that that's the science scientifically definitive, but it seemed like there was an absence of a year class. Did that correspond with the blob that we heard out in the high seas pasture, which was a large area of very warm water that just was too warm for fish to swim in or feed in? And we either had substandard weights of fish coming back. In fact, last year was the lowest
right.
average
weight. Yeah, they were small fish, too, the ones that did
they
make
were.
It back.
A 5.7-pound average across the spectrum was pretty small, smallest in history. So those science-driven projects, which are now under the budget scrutiny every year, and probably even more so now, result in less opportunity for fishermen. If we don't have the science behind them, the fishing biologists are less likely to give opportunity when they're uncertain about what they have and what those yields might be. It's a huge part of fisheries, the fishery as we know it.
Yeah.
And it seems to be getting less, not more definitive, but less definitive.
Ken Coleman joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. 283-8414 is the number if you'd like to jump in on the talk this morning, talking all about, mostly commercial fishing and really specifically set net fishing, and a topic that we're going to be coming back to in the coming weeks as we look ahead to the 2019 fishing season here on the Kenai Peninsula. Again, 283-8414 is the number. Talking about the capacity and sort of the desire to do some of these scientific studies, really curious about your thoughts on some administrative changes when we talk about fish and game. Doug Vincent Lag now at the head of fish and game, and you kind of brushed on it a little bit, is the idea that the purse strings that control how these studies get done, whether they get done, if they're funded, if there are enough scientists to be out there asking these questions, all very important to how these fisheries are prosecuted. What are your thoughts on the new administration and any thoughts on any direction it might go?
Well, there was consternation, as you may imagine. Governor Walker was a very fair-minded person who would listen to all sides. There's been a characterization that Governor Dunleavy, in his previous political position as senator from the Mat-Su Valley, was particularly want to characterize this correctly, was particularly about sport fishermen, or he espoused the sport fishing side of the house,
mm-hmm.
Wanting to make sure that fish got to his area, and very vocal about reasons he thought they didn't get there, the fish, and that concern makes us wonder, as commercial fishermen, how and who will be running the fisheries. There's, as I understand now, I don't know Mr. Vincent Lang, met him once at a board, but he's purported to be mostly game oriented, which he's the administrator. It doesn't have to be one or the other, as long as he's an effective administrator. But then to step down from there as a deputy commissioners and directors of both sport and commercial fish on the commercial fish or on the fish side, who will they be? Will they be Will they be old hands from the department, political hires who want to do a particular thing? Those things will all concern us. And then probably last but not least, who will be future Board of Fish appointees? We've got people will call it a balanced board today. Basically, three sport fishermen, three commercial fishing, and a personal use or a subsistence person. It's not quite that way. We do have a local representative, Robert Ruffner, mm-hmm. who, in my estimation, is a very fair individual who has not put his bet on one or the other. He really looks at things from a scientific point of view, and in fact is a scientific-driven type person, and that's refreshing to know that we've got an interjection of science into that process. An aside, as you know, the 2020 Board of Fish meeting was supposed to be held in the Kenai-Soldotna area.
Right. This was big news. This hadn't happened in a long time because, well, for some interesting reasons, I guess it would be the diplomatic way to put that.
For 20 years, since 1999, and when there was a tumultuous meeting at the Soldotna Sports Center that was very emotional, although it wasn't violent in any stretch of the imagination. It was boisterous.
It wasn't an easy meeting probably to get through. I certainly wasn't there, but not an easy meeting to get through. Yeah.
Yeah. I was there. It's all with my wife and all many of my neighbors and friends. And it was emotional, but it wasn't out of control or anything characterized like that. But we were successful and many people put a lot of time into, and including politicians, our local delegation and many people involved within the fishery to try to bring that Board of Fish, next Board of Fish to Kenai, where it seems like we spend our time at the Board of Fish adjudicating the Kenai Peninsula issues.
Over those 2 weeks, I mean, days and days, yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
And so bringing it here only seems to be a fair thing to do on as it would be to go to Anchorage or the Mat-Su Valley because that we're in that area of the state. That's
right.
Our board. And it is... apparently, the decision to be holding that meeting here on the Kenai is going to be revisited on Friday by the Board of Fish. That will be, I think, in the morning on Friday, and you can listen online on the state line. They broadcast all Board of Fish
right.
hearings live, and I already know some people that are going to be up there on Friday. And we hope that we continue to have the meeting here, or they will continue with that thought process. But it may well be that Anchorage will end up being the venue in 2020.
Yeah, that was really exciting news when that announcement first came out. People were, and for a lot of practical reasons too, as you pointed out, you know, again those big Upper Cook Inlet meetings that come along every so often go on for 2 weeks. And as you said, a vast majority of what's discussed has to do with the Kenai River, and fisheries very close to the Kenai River in this specific part of Cook Inlet. So it would have been interesting to have that meeting down here and save everybody those trips to Anchorage for once. But
it's a burden.
It can be.
You really have to go up there and stay for the entire 2 weeks because even though you have a commercial proposals that are testified to or adjudicated, and you've also got the sport fish side of things, which would greatly change the flavor of what's done on the commercial side, or vice versa. And so you really have to go up there and understand what's going on and listen. And then the board has in the past done an about face on things at the mm-hmm. last minute. It didn't happen in the last hearing, but the previous one it did. And so you really have to protect your interests, be involved for the 2 weeks, and it's a financial burden for everybody, not just commercial fishermen,
and
sport fishermen alike.
Yeah, and for folks who haven't been to these big Upper Cook Inlet Board of Fish meetings, I've been to a couple for a few days at a time, and they are fascinating, and the sort of machination of how those meetings work. They are so dynamic because it's not a simple matter of going down an agenda and checking stuff off the list. We're taking breaks all the time to discuss things and bring in scientists and bring in extra people for testimony and answer questions as they come up from the Board of Fish. And if you want to sell your case for a particular decision, there's no other way to do it than to be there.
Oh, by all means. It's a fascinating process. You start out with declarations of conflicts, and then it goes into the house cleaning business from the board, and then on to staff reports, which in and of themselves are pretty important and fascinating. To get inside, the science is real important for us. And then you begin with public testimony, where everybody gets 3 minutes to say what they will, and that may take two or three
that
or longer
take days. Yeah,
I've seen it take a long time in the past. And by the way, I've been to every board since 1977. I've seen a lot of it. It's been more streamlined, but it's still, to get the bulk of the business done, takes 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you get into the adjudication of these regulations or proposed regulatory changes, and the only input you have is by writing a record copy to the board and posting it, or ex parte communication. As you mentioned, they take lots of breaks, and you rush up and try to take advantage of some board member who may be walking out to
get a cup of coffee or something. Yeah.
And you get them along out in the hall, and you try to give them your conventional wisdom why you think something should go the way you would like it to, or something else. It's quite a dance. It is. And it's packed with emotion and anxiety. It's one would have to be there to understand the experience.
To be sure. Again, Ken Coleman joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation, talking all about the upcoming 2019 fishing season and some of the science questions around that, the policy questions that commercial fishermen have as they are prepared to hopefully get back and do some work this year after a pretty down year in 2018. 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414 if you would like to get in on the conversation this morning. You know, in talking about some of these policy things, and you mentioned a lot of experience and being at a lot of Board of Fish meetings, you know, I'm curious. I've been covering these things for a little less than a decade now, and have been at times surprised at how charged some of the policy debates can be, and at times equally surprised at how well people can come together and work on stuff and attack a certain question. And I would just be curious to know sort of your characterization of how those policy debates and how those relationships between the various user groups have changed over the years. Is it the Cook Inlet fish wars that what earned it that reputation, and is it still like that?
Well, it is certainly for some people, and I would say early on in my career, when I started working in the politics side of things, or interest in going to these board hearings and find out why things are changed the way they are, and it was more of a congenial atmosphere, but it quickly became more fiery, if you will, as time went by. In fact, it changed a lot. We went from, a smaller fishery to a larger population, and with that became a lot more emotions, people not understanding why they don't get fish when they want to get fish, and of course, fish don't clock in every day.
Or
swim on the weekends, or come into the mouth on the weekends. And then people's financial interests also drive a lot of their emotion, and it became what I called red hot. And then as the fisheries continued to grow, and there was more people in the river wanting sport fish for the river, and more set netters on the East Beach trying to partake in their businesses, I think it went from a red hot to a white hot war. And it just tears our community apart every year. Part of the reason that I and others have tried to do the gear reduction is financial viability, of course.
That's convenient. We always like to have that test right now. Good news. We passed the test. All right. Very good.
Okay.
So yeah, getting back to the gear reduction. Yeah.
So we were, so, trying to recall where I was. We there's a lot of emotion that surrounds us.
Sure.
And as I said, people wanting fish for their particular niche in the world, and some getting some components of the resource users getting bigger, some staying the same, and some having proliferated over the years. There seems to be nobody's satisfied. Some people say, well, that's compromise, but in fish wars, that's literally the fodder for for the war itself. And so what we've tried to do with this is take a look at what makes sense as a fishery. Can we re-inject financial viability into a stressed fishery? At the same time, can we somewhat demystify what we do as set netters? Do we catch all those kings? No, we don't. But the emotional reaction is, sure you do. Well, I can tell you that we don't. Many of us have tried to mitigate our catching techniques so that we don't even do that. But the part of the to go to your point is how do you stop this, or how do you diffuse this white hot fish war that tears us apart every year? We're hoping that maybe this will be, from the set netter's point of view, a way to begin to have dialogue with those on the other side of the sport fish side or the personal use side about responsible harvest from our perspective and a continuance in the diversified local economy. So it has resulted in the ability to have discussions with those folks that we generally never talk to. I've had those discussions. It's not always easy. Sometimes I have to swallow my pride and step forward and talk to somebody I hadn't spoken to, but yet was around for the last 30 or 40 years. And surprisingly, we found some common ground. I don't know that we'll ever be best friends in terms of the things we do, but the ability to have that discussion, a frank discussion on what are the needs from each side, is, I think, a step forward. And I likened it to detente. We may not like each other so much, but we've learned to live together, and here are the ways that we can do that in a cooperative way.
Yeah,
it's not perfect, but certainly it's a step forward, I like to think.
Well, and in so many instances I've heard over the years, people love to talk about just the simple fact that Alaska does still have a very viable and important commercial fishing scene. I mean, across the state, Cook Inlet, Bristol Bay, all over, we do still have a lot of commercial fishing here. It's very economically important. We still have that. That in and of itself is pretty remarkable when you look at sort of the history of commercial salmon fishing on this area of the Pacific Ocean. I sort of lost my train of thought there too. I had that EAS noise buzzing in my head there for a second. But when you look at the question would be, what do you see as the opportunities to sort of build on that? Because again, when we hear these discussions, people are so proud of the fact that we do still have these fisheries. You always hear Alaska has a chance to do it differently. Sometimes I hear some of these discussions and I go, it doesn't sound like we're really doing anything differently. It sounds like we're very much on our way to arguing over the very last fish. What do you see as a way around that so that we can continue to have that discussion and say, yes, we are still here?
Well, I think that the parties need to be responsible. They need to be accepting of information and the flow of information coming back to you, so you know exactly what you're talking about and not just respond with emotion. We are commercial fisheries, a big part of Alaska's economic picture, and then locally, we're so lucky here on the Kenai to have this diversified economy. Obviously, we're close to the gas and oil fields of Cook Inlet and have been for well over 50 years now. We've got a big tourist industry and a sport fishery, and the commercial fishery has been around here as a mainstay to the economy, the cash economy, for well over 100 years. And so acceptance, demystification, I think, is what do you guys do? How do you do it? And do all those buoys mean there's all these nets? Are you catching all the fish? I saw a blog on ADN here just this morning. Well, they catch everything. Well, obviously we don't. There are only certain days that we normally fish. We get liberalized when there's a larger biomass. The drift fleet gets put in certain areas to make sure that fish move to the northern district. It's becoming a bit dicier for them over the years as a result of that.
Yep.
We get less fishing time based on king salmon. So how do we stay in the game, if you will, with all these pressures of people wanting more and more and more? Well, we have to adapt somewhat. Gear reduction is one of the things. Some of the fishermen around the mouth of the river who realize who understand that having met Chinook management plans means opportunity have voluntarily, and I'm not espousing this for the whole fishery, but voluntarily reduced our nets depth by normally do 45 meshes deep. Where I do all my nets at 29 now. I'm trying to get fish underneath those,
mm-hmm.
king salmon, Chinook primarily are bottom
right.
swimmers, and sockeye are the top column fishers.
Yep.
And we're trying to fish it, and we're trying to catch a sockeye but let the others go. That's a trade-off, if you will, on an economic level and a need social level, if you will, to try to get those fish into the hands of people who covet those while still being able to harvest sockeye, which is our targeted money fish.
That's your bread and butter fish.
It is.
You know, and I wonder, in talking about maybe having a few, some fewer permits out there, does the future of the Eastside set net fishery in particular, is it kind of more of a boutique fishery that really relies on its own marketing? Is this very specialized sort of niche product that you just can't get anywhere else because, in a very real sense, you can't?
Well, that's a good point. The marketing is a big part of this, self-marketing. The fishery we all probably see early in the spring is the Copper River fishery, where they've done a masterful job of marketing the first.
That makes headlines
first,
all over the world.
And the oiliest sockeye and Chinook. And, of course, Alaska Airlines flies a salmon-colored
yep.
jet in there, and they pick the – anyway, we had – you're right. People have said it's a boutique fishery. I have trouble with that word. I don't know why. It just doesn't seem right. Boutique doesn't go along with fish, but at any rate, we had Kenai Wild, which is the people trying to brand the Kenai fish, and I wouldn't say just Kenai, but Kusiloff as well.
Sure.
But it has probably become a niche fishery in that respect. We're trying to be value added. Just like the Copper River brand, if we can do that in the Kenai and do it appropriately and come up with the right product with the right packaging, the quality is a big issue and then that commands higher prices, and so of course that drives the bottom line.
That seems to be the direction it's heading, is because you can sort of bake right into your business plan as a fisherman that your opportunities for catching fish in general are trending sort of down, and unless you have those one or two few really big days, the volume simply isn't going to be there. So you have to make that dollar up somewhere else, and that tends to be on the back end of things.
Right. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, as we kind of wind down, my gosh, I can't believe we're getting down to towards the end of the program already. It just goes so quick sometimes. You know, really curious, again, you know, looking back with someone who's been in the fishery for now going on half a century, does that seem weird to say sometimes?
It does. It really does.
I'm curious. We talked about when you first started fishing, the drift fishery wasn't fully in effect.
Well, I hesitate to talk about their numbers, but like many of us in Cook Inlet back in the early days, and I would say this is just post commercial fish, the entry program, the Commercial Fishing Entry Commission, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. the permits, that there were more permits out there in families or latent than there were actually fishing. And so it was a point-driven system. There was a matrix of how long did you fish? Were you in a family to fish? Where did you these kinds of things, not necessarily numbers of fish, which drove numbers of permits, but did you qualify for the criteria? And so for a family of four, maybe a mother and father and two children all got permits, but they may have only used two of those. Those kinds of things were prevalent back then. in the early or mid-70s, late-70s, early-80s, we weren't really sure exactly how the whole program was going to shake itself out. Would those permits that weren't being used be taken back by the state? Did you have to use them or report earnings on them? Really, we were uncertain, and I'm sure this felt the same way in the drift fishery, that people had permits that weren't used. But again, we had these up-and-coming programs. We had enhancement programs in the Kenai and the Kosilof, which were driving and survival yields that were just incredible at the time. Perfect ocean survival, perfect in-river survival. I mean, things like that were coming to the fore. And so it naturally, you'd start using more of those permits. There was more fish than the number of permits that were there at the time, being fished at the mm-hmm. time, could possibly harvest. So we grew. And we're on the other side of that now. There's no longer any meaningful enhancement in Central Cook Inlet. Not that there isn't a means to do it. There are technical things that keep us from having those. Although I would say that would sure help some of the issues of driving personal use and things like that, where we could possibly aquaculture or run into a specific place up in the upper in the Northern Cook Inlet that would be helpful and disseminating some of that pressure that's at the mouth of the Kenai.
Yeah, the
Kosilof.
Yes, the personal use fisheries on both of those rivers. Gosh, there's a whole other hour, and I'm sure that we will get to that eventually as we get a little bit closer to July when those fish start pulsing back. You know, in just the last couple of minutes that we have here, Ken, best fishing year you've ever had.
Numbers or dollars?
How about best fishing year numbers and best fishing year because does it translate to dollars?
It certainly does. I mean, numbers of fish, depending on what the price is, certainly transforms or equates to dollars. 1987, mm-hmm. When we had in excess of 9 million fish come to the Kenai and the Kosilof River, I think everybody in the inlet had a, if not a record year. Nearly record. I can't imagine those who didn't. Even on peripheral fisheries, there were so many fish in the inlet, even people on the west side got a taste of some of that. In terms of just sheer dollars, we had the highest price in history and with a very good run as well in 1988, and it drove those. 1989, personally, I had a great year, but you have to remember that was the Exxon Valdez year, and all those fish on the commercial side were harvested by set netters because our drift brothers and sisters didn't get the fish.
That's right, yeah.
Which was very unfortunate for them.
And do those years sort of automatically translate as good fishing years for you personally, just as a memory, as an experience, or are there other years that maybe weren't so good on the pocketbook, but gosh, it was fun to be out there?
Oh, certainly. There are the years when the sun shines and the wind doesn't blow too hard and you're out on the water, you're still having fish coming over the gunwale, you've got your family with you. It's the best of all times, and it doesn't always translate to dollars. It translates to family and a way of life.
And that's, again, getting back to that sort of that cultural aspect of it, and we've talked about, public testimony at policy meetings and all these sorts of things. That right there that you were just talking about is why why that testimony gets so heated, why the quote-unquote fish wars are white hot, because there is that component of it's fishing, and it's a special thing to share with family and everything else.
It certainly is. I feel the juices flowing right now just having talked to you about this. The best years of our lives, and I hope I speak for my wife as well, is having our two boys and being in a skiff and doing those things. It's so fulfilling, and fishing is, it gets in your blood, as they say.
Yeah,
it's certainly in my blood, has been for most of my life, and I hope that we get to do it in the future with others as well.
Yeah, we've got a lot of work to do yet to get ready for 19. I guess we were talking before the show.
Well, there's some mechanical things that no matter whether you fish a lot or you don't fish a lot, there's always the prep things that need to occur. Network is probably at a minimum because we didn't really get to fish that much last year. There's always political work to be done. We've got the proposal season for the Board of Fish coming
right
up for the 2020 session, so I expect every commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet has got a mind toward that right now.
And when it comes to preparing and hiring crew for the year, I kind of slipped my mind to ask about this earlier when we were talking about some of the uncertainties that that the Eastside Setnet fleet has had to deal with. Hiring crew, that's a big uncertainty as well that you have to contend with, because you know you're going to need people, but how many and for how long? Those are tough questions to answer in February and March when you're looking for folks.
Well, they are. They become almost emergent an issue the closer the season gets,
yeah,
and the tougher it is to find people. We used to have people who fished with us and stayed with us for a decade or more because they just loved doing it. The latter years, the later years, has been, the last few years, has, say the last 10, has been very difficult to get a crew and keep a crew. And I'd say that goes for both a set net fishery and a drift fishery because of all the uncertainty surrounding the plans and the volatility of these runs. It's been very difficult to recruit somebody,
yeah,
and say you're going to make X when we don't know if we're going to make X or Y or Z. It's really getting difficult.
Is there still a lot of recruitment from outside, you know, college kids coming up from the summer, that sort of classic picture of who we think about working those sites?
Well, it used to be, but no, not anymore.
Anymore.
No, I think we're getting people who are, you know, unemployed folks who've been around and can't get any summertime work, and inexperience is the rule rather than the exception now, and so every year is a begins anew. We have to teach everybody from soup to nuts, and it's becoming real hard.
And
as your kids grow up and they gravitate maybe to other things, maybe they stay in fishing, maybe they don't. You're having a hard time.
You can't count on them to be there every summer.
No, you can't.
Yeah, that's interesting. You don't tend to think. This is yet another thing where I think about fishermen and farmers being very similar, in that there's all these other things that you have to do besides just pick fish out of the water, just pick plants out of the ground. We're talking about human resources things and marketing things and the whole gamut. But a lot to consider as we head toward the season. We're just about out of time, Ken. Again, I wanted to thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us a little bit today. It's great to talk with you.
Very much appreciated. Love to come back sometime.
We'll have to do that. Maybe as we get to out of the fishing season and things slow down, we'll get a recap of 2019 down the road.
Great. Thanks.